I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One. All right, happy 4th of July to all my American listeners, and happy Canada Day 3 days earlier to everybody from Canada. I'm from Canada, you idiot. I'm from Winnipeg, you idiot. And my fellow Canadians, Tyson Kidd and Natalia Neidhart, are here with me sharing crazy stories about the legendary Hart family, their family, the most unique and biggest and most legendary family in wrestling history. They're going to be here talking about the Montreal Screwjob, the aftermath of said Screwjob, what it took to broker the peace between Brett and Sean, and Brett and Vince, even more importantly. We got some funny stories about Owen Hart, Ross Hart, Bruce Hart, Dean Hart, Teddy Hart, Natalia's grandpa Stu, the patriarch of the Hart family. So many great stories. If you love wrestling, or if you love the Hart family, or if you don't know anything about them, you're still going to love this episode. Plus, you get to hear my recollections of the Harts, going to the Hart family wrestling school, and also coming face-to-face with Smith Hart in the Hart family house. Crazy story. Told it before, gonna tell it again.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride, cause it's Friday.
It's Friday.
I love that song. Always makes me feel happy no matter what the circumstances are. All right, today we're talking the wrestling family dynasty, the Harts. So many of them. And we've got Natty Neidhart, daughter of Jim the Anvil. And we also got TJ Wilson, a.k.a. Tyson Kidd, who grew up with the Harts. He actually just had a very serious injury, very serious surgery. This happened before the surgery. So we talked to Tyson a few months ago. We're wishing him all the best. He's a strong guy. He's a great wrestler. He's a great performer. He's in great shape. I think he can come back from this injury and be better than ever. I know he can. And in the meantime, we've got some hilarious stories to tell about the Hart family, the family that he grew up in that adopted him as one of their own. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we'll find out, I'm sure. Lots of funny stories, and lots of funny stories on my new Comedy Central digital series, Nothing to Report. We got 6 episodes, about 5 minutes long each. Nuggets of comedy joy. I guarantee you'll laugh at least once, maybe even twice. And thanks to all of you, we're racking up the views, and hopefully that leads to more episodes. If you're looking for something a little more serious, though, try out Big Show in Vendetta. He's with Dean Cain as an evil villain up against Dean Cain's renegade cop. It's a great movie. Good for show. Good for all of us. It's on demand right now or on DVD. That's called Vendetta. Go check that out and go check out Nothing to Report. We've got over 1.5 million downloads thanks to you. And keep on checking out Tough Enough. We had week 2, show number 2 this week, and we're definitely tightening it up a bit, and you're starting to see the battle lines being drawn, the personalities coming out, and I'm really enjoying it. I had more fun this week as well. I think everybody's kind of figuring out what their roles are, figuring out what they're there to do and what they're there not to do. And once again, another great rating. The show has become a hit. And we're very excited to see where it takes us as the countdown to elimination has begun each and every week for all of the competitors on Tough Enough. There's 11 left. But I finished up the show and went straight to the hotel airport hotel, and then flew out the next day to come to Japan. It was 3 hours from Orlando to Dallas, then 13 hours from Dallas to Tokyo. I'm in Tokyo right now looking out at a rainy downtown Tokyo area. I flew over on the plane with Paige, which was great. I watched the movie Get Hard, which was very funny. I hadn't seen it yet, with Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart. If you want to check that out, you should. It's very, very funny. And as I was driving out of Narita, it takes about 2 hours to get from Narita to Tokyo, I text a good friend of mine, Masanori Hori, who I've known for many, many years. He's a big fan here and a good friend. And I asked him, how many times have I been to Japan? He's like, these guys really into all the stats and everything like that. So he sent me all of the tours that I've done. And I didn't know, had I done 60 tours? Had I done 30 tours? I just know that I'd been a whole, you know, shitload of times. And it turns out this is my 43rd tour of Japan, which is amazing to think about it. I'm 44 years old and I've been to Japan 43 times. I'll take it. And he actually went through all of the different tours. So it's kind of like a trip down memory lane to see all these tours. My first one was October 10th, 1991, when I came over for FMW. So I was 20 years old, my first trip to Japan. 20 years old, I was making $600 a week. I was over there for, I thought it was 3 weeks, but it's only two. See, you're seeing everything here. It was a two-week tour, and I learned a lot, you know, and I didn't go back again until 1992 when Lance and I were supposed to go back as Sudden Impact, but he didn't want to go, so I got another guy in there replacing him. His name was Kevin Hool, who they called Kevin Fall, and he fell, all right, fell off the face of the earth, fell into obscurity. And that was my second tour of Japan. I never got a chance to come back until I was working in Mexico, and I hooked up with Ultimo Dragon, who brought me over for War, Wrestle and Romance, which is always funny to me. You know, it's a real rock and roll name, Wrestle and Romance. It's a tough name there. And that was in February of 1994, and that was my third Japanese tour with King Haku, Ryo, Lord of the Jungle, if you remember him. He was a like an Ultimate Warrior ripoff. And Mr. Hughes, who went on to become my valet about 5 years later, my manager, whatever you want to call him, my bodyguard, I guess would be a better term. And I remember he was always excited because his sunglasses never came off while he was wrestling. He was very proud of that. It's probably the best thing about his work, too. So, and then kept coming all the way through 1994. I remember this because I was working in Smoky Mountain Wrestling at the same time. So I remember I would come over, do the Smoky Mountain Wrestling tapings, and then come over to Japan. The tours were really short, but I would still come over there. I remember I came over for a one-day six-man tournament June 30th, 1994. My partners were Dos Catas, who is the father of Alberto Del Rio, and Thunderbird Brett Como, a good friend of mine from Calgary, Alberta. He was wrestling as the Ultimate Dragon, the Black Dragon. So we came and did a six-man tag team tournament then, and then we came back in July, and that was me and Vampiro and Warlord against Onita, Bam Bam Bigelow, and Tenryu. We had that match, and we lost that match when Onita pinned me. But if you remember, if you read my book, A Lion's Tale, that I moonsaulted Onita and hit him in the face with my knee, and that was we had to like pick him off the mat, which was pretty funny. I could have pinned him and been the renegade hero that pins Onita, but instead I had to pick him up and kind of pin myself because he was knocked out. So, yeah, lots of great matches, lots of great tours. Then you hit 1995 when I was coming over every single month. I'd work 2 months in Japan and go home for 2 months. And we really had built up our junior heavyweight division with Gato and Yasuroka and Negro Casas was here, 1-2-3 Kid. They had a guy called Orihara who was great. Como was here. Ultimo Dragon, Gato, Jado, you know, Lance Storm came over. So it was really a really good time for junior heavyweights. So much to the point that we actually, I remember Dragon and I, it's actually on this list, June 29th, 1995, like 20 years ago, in the Izumo Dome in Shimane, we headlined the show. And for junior heavyweights to headline, that's a big deal. Like, you never would really see that happen too much. So we really had made some good strides there. And I remember that match, too. We killed it. And then a few days later, July 7th, 1995, at the Sumo Hall, Rogoku Koku Gaikan, which is where I'm wrestling tonight against Finn Balor, Lionheart beat Ultimo Dragon in 20 minutes to keep the WAR International Junior Heavyweight title. And that was the match that really put me on the map. If you want to talk about a breakthrough match that when people saw it, started kind of getting my name out there. I know that Jimmy Hart, I think Benoit had it and gave it to Jimmy Hart. And Jimmy Hart gave it to Kevin Sullivan and Eric Bischoff and said, this kid is great. I remember, I think Mick Foley gave that match to Paul Heyman. I think Benoit gave that match to Paul Heyman. So it was that match that helped me get into ECW and WCW. It was a great, great match against Ultimo Dragon, one of my favorite opponents of all time. And I think that match was on my very first DVD, behind Breaking the Code, Behind the Walls of Jericho, whatever it was, whatever it was called. Breaking the Walls Down or something, whatever, the first DVD I did, you know what I'm talking about, from about 5 years ago. I think that match is on there, and if it is, you should go check it out. If not, it's probably on YouTube. It was a great, great performance at the time. I mean, a lot of high spots and a lot of flying, but you definitely could see what I could do, and that was, like I said, a real kind of a breakthrough match for me. And then looking through the rest of the years, you know, going through there with all these guys, with Big Titan and Dr. Luther and all my friends that were on there, Hector Garza, who's not with us anymore, and Brazo, the Los Brazos, Brazo de Plata, Brazo de Oro, El Brazo. He's got all the tours that I've done with all the foreign guys that were on it, so you can see all that. And then, of course, the Super J Cup second stage, December 13th, 1995, where I worked with Chris Benoit for the first time. And Liger won that tournament. So, and then kind of went through 96, worked through the first half of the year in 96, and finished off with a big 8-man tag in 1996, where I gorilla pressed Rey Mysterio off the top rope. While we were standing on the top rope, I gorilla pressed him. It was pretty impressive. I posted a picture of it on Instagram a few weeks ago. But yeah, good times, man. And then I was gone for Japan for a while until I came back. I went to WCW. I came back in 1997, January 4th, as Super Liger, which was Liger's big rival. Totally bombed. I sucked. I fell off the top rope. I couldn't see anything. I put on a terrible match, and that was pretty much the end of my time in New Japan, except for the next tour was already booked. The visas were already booked, so I was allowed to come back just as Chris Jericho, and I killed it, and that's when they started bringing me back to New Japan fairly regularly. I did the Best of the Super Junior tournament. I did another tournament, or another tour in September. I remember I worked with Benoit over there. We had some great matches. And then my last tour was tagging with Eddie Guerrero against Shinjiro Otani and Tatsuhito Takaiwa, Jericho, and the Black Tiger, and that was in 98. All right. Then came back with WWE in 2002. We sold out the Yokohama Dome at about 18,000 people. It was Jericho versus The Rock, and that's when afterwards we had this great match, and then we had like a 20-minute, you know, comedy segment at the end of it, which, you know, we always love doing. Pat Patterson hated it. Well, you guys put on these great matches, and then you do this stupid comedy after. And it's like, you know, no one gets a chance to see The Rock. We're going to give him The Rock. So he was talking about how he loved pie, and then I said I hated pie. I only like strudel, and we kind of argued back and forth, and I told him under my breath, I said, call me Okama. He said, what? I said, call me Okama. He said, you don't like pie? What are you, some kind of Okama? And Okama in Japanese means gay, so everyone started chanting Okama, and it was even on the front cover of the Tokyo Sports the next day. Rock calls Jericho Okama, because I can read Japanese, so there you go. You know, 15 years of terrorizing Japan thrown away in one night. But then I worked with Tajiri and Benoit and Shawn Michaels over the years. Randy Orton, Ricky Steamboat, we worked together in the Budokan before we started working in the sumo arena basically every summer. I worked with Yoshitatsu. I worked with Cesaro last time, Curtis Axel, and then tonight against Finn Balor, and tomorrow night against Adrian Neville, and very excited to do that. I always love coming back to Japan because I feel like I grew up here. I learned a lot from working here and really made a name for myself. Far and beyond I could have anywhere else, and kind of really embraced the Japanese culture and ingratiated myself with the Japanese culture. And every time I come back, I take it very seriously, and I really, it's a great honor for me to work in Japan, and I'm very, very excited to do so. And I'm excited to deliver this to you from Japan, my room in Tokyo. I got some podcast guests coming in a little later on, and we're going to have a lot of fun during the next couple of days, and I will tell you all about it. And we're going to have a lot of fun with Natty Neidhart and Tyson Kidd. They're coming up.
Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you always say that you guys listen to the podcast. And you were actually one of the first guests that I had probably in the first 20 episodes or 30 episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, we love the podcast.
Repeat Defender.
Yeah. Repeat Defender, I know. Exactly. You were the first WWE performer that I asked for when I went through the the protocol. They said, well, give me a list of who you want. And I said, well, I want Natty on there because she's nuts.
Yeah. And I like being nuts. Because
some of those heart stories.
Being normal is just too – it's like so boring.
No, but it's part of your background. That's why I wanted to have you guys. We got Natty Neidhart and we got TJ Wilson here.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tyson Kidd. I always still call you TJ.
Now we're Total Divas. Now there's like
the – now everyone calls you Tyson,
yeah,
right?
And TJ, there's a – used to be like at Access would always be like the fans letting me know that they Wikipedia'd my name. But now it's like – now it's this weird hybrid, the lines blurred of like,
yeah.
Sometimes I'll come out in an arena and the kids will be saying TJ as I'm walking to the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And so like they've seen Total Divas.
Maybe Total Jerk.
No. Maybe they've seen more on Total Divas even than sometimes.
So in Divas, you're TJ.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been like a big boost for your career, right?
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely.
Like you're more popular now than you've ever been from being on Divas probably,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I think is also what's helped me get my foot in the door with – to like keep advancing and even like
of course, yeah.
deal with NXT, which has kind of helped like resurge everything stems from Total Divas.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's so cool to see because you guys have been working here for a long time. And obviously, Natty, you've been at the top of the Divas division for a while. And TJ, you've had different pushes and different combinations of things that have worked and then stop and start. And yes. now you're getting a chance to kind of really show.
Yeah, yeah.
Which show is- not only everyone knows your wrestling skills are top notch off the charts, but now you get a chance to show your personality too, which you've always also had.
Yeah, and it's like I've had a lot of the guys come up to me recently and say, you know what, now you're the guy out there that you are back here. And it's like I've done commentary now a couple times the last couple weeks on like main event. And when I got to the back, everybody said, the boys all came up and said, man, you were the same on commentary as you are when you're commentating at the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's good. That's like what my goal was, is to try to show that I do have a personality. I don't just walk around like a drawn stick man walking around.
Right. Which is funny, though, because when you talk about, you know, sometimes guys that can really work with a lot of talent, a lot of, I don't know, if it's aerial ability or whatever you want to say, the personality isn't really there, but you have that, and you have a great personality too, Natty.
Thanks.
I think a lot of that is because you guys grew up in the system, in the Hart family system, where everybody is a character. And that's what I wanted to have you guys on, because I know we always laugh, say the Harts are crazy. I say crazy in the most loving way.
Yeah.
It is definitely the weirdest, craziest, funniest, strangest family ever.
Ever.
And people who think they know are like, oh, yeah, the Harts. But hearing the real stories of just how loopy the family is.
Loopy in a whole new, like, and I feel like I don't know. It's like I'm really proud to be a part of the family because of how nuts they are. And in the most loving and endearing and charming way. And then you throw in that little Neidhart, like, the fact that my dad's also a bit nuts. And then it's like, gosh, I really like Road Dogg said to me at the last TV taping, he's like, I think you're a little nuts. And I was like, thank you.
That's like Sunday dinner. You had to bring a personality. It was like the most, like this long going WWE pre-tape. The whole Sunday dinner, everybody's at the table and like.
There's a reality show, right?
Exactly. If there had been a camera just in the middle of the table, kind of rotating, you'd have endless material.
Now you're talking about the Sunday dinner at Stu's house, which was up a place called in Coach Hill in Calgary. It was kind of up on a hill, a big mansion.
Yeah.
Right. And this was the place where every Sunday the whole family would come over for dinner, right?
Right.
So first of all, so your dad is Jim Neidhart. Who's your mom?
My mom's Ellie. She's Ellie. The first girl in the Hart family. So there's 12 kids.
So let's Smith, go through the 12.
Yeah. Smith, Bruce, Keith, Wayne, my mom, Ellie. And then there's
Dean's before, right?
Oh, shoot, Dean?
Yeah.
I hate when you correct me. Smith, Bruce, Keith, Wayne, Dean. Thank you. Ellie, Brett, Georgia, Allison, Ross, Diana, Owen. So my mom and Brett are like right next to each
one
other.
One after another.
Yeah, so there's always been like a real serious rivalry between the two of them. Very serious. And they actually both kind of sort of look alike.
Really?
Yeah, I always see like...
Oh yeah, definitely.
I always saw like Owen and Diana. They always kind of like to me looked alike. And then Brett and my mom always like...
Well, it's really funny too because a couple of the Harts like really strikingly good looking. And then a couple of the other Harts are kind of like kind of weird looking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you see like Brett... like Brett and Owen, and then they were like such good looking guys, like, you know.
Yeah.
And then you see someone like Ross, who's not a really a good looking
well
guy.
Ross did design my very first ring costume, actually. And because of that, I think a lot of people might have mistaken me for a man, but we're not gonna get into that.
Thighs like her father.
Yeah, thighs like her daddy.
Very traditional wrestling.
Yeah, I Ross. Remember that was actually very traumatizing going back on it. But Ross really, I mean, one of the comments he was telling the seamstress, Crazy Colleen was her name.
She a Calgary girl?
Or? She was from a town, I think, in Cochrane.
Okay. So
you know Cochrane.
Yeah.
Just outside. Just
yeah, just outside.
Same thing.
And he was like, not too much boob. Well, no shit, Ross. Excuse my language. No shit, Ross. I don't need to look like Kurt Angle, except for Kurt Angle showed a lot more boob than me. You know what I mean? And I had this outfit that just made me look like I was 300 pounds. And I was like, I already am Jim Neidhart's daughter. Stop. Like,
you already got shot.
Stop it.
Putting legs, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they are JR approved because Jim Ross always commented on my thick thigh.
Oh, God.
He really did? He would really say that?
No, that's just Natty's interpretation of
DJ,
like
stop
her, how she thought JR commentated when he was on SmackDown.
Don't interrupt me, please.
Uh-oh.
Thanks.
That you live in the crazy world.
Now, but you aren't officially a blood-related Hart.
No.
But you pretty much grew up in the Hart family.
Yeah,
right?
I went to school with maybe the craziest of all, Teddy.
Teddy
so,
Hart.
Yeah, we became friends at 10 years old, and then remember he kept inviting me to his house, which he said was a gym. And as a kid, I'm thinking like a gymnasium, like in our school.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to his house. Finally, he's convinced me. He also has ice cream. Come on, at least you'll get some ice cream. I go to his house, and it's a gym, a workout gym. And first person he introduces me to is this woman on a bike. And he said, this is George. And I was like, okay, why is he introducing me to gym members? And it turns out that's his mom.
He called her George.
Yeah, he called her George.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, was Georgia. But yeah, okay. He called his parents by their first names.
Yeah,
well, at 10 years old.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, always. So I mean, like, and then next thing you know, I was going, "Hey, do you want to come up to my grandfather's house?" And then absolutely snowballed into everything, into wrestling, watching wrestling every week, and like somehow, like I'd seen it before, obviously, and I was a fan, but growing up with a single mom and two sisters, younger sisters, I'd watch wrestling and then want to try some of it at home on my sisters. So that got
so kind of like going to the Harts was kind of like a, I'm not going to say father figure, but gave you kind of the male element. That
yeah, 100%, 100%.
Wow, okay.
Especially like Ted's dad, definitely.
That's BJ.
Yeah, BJ. Yes.
No, it's such a. Somebody last night was in the dressing room. I think it was maybe Wyatt or something. He goes, "Who's the biggest wrestling family?" And like, he's like, "My family's the biggest." Okay, well, you got Wyatt and Rotundo, and there's a couple dudes in the windows, but your family has so many different layers of wrestlers and guys involved in the business.
It just extends. Like,
so,
I think,
yeah. So go ahead.
Oh no, I think even Roddy Piper is somehow like related to our family. Like he's a cousin of.
He would always say that with Roddy. You never know if he's serious or not. But like, he always said he's a cousin of you guys.
Yeah, because you have Stu, who's like the patriarch. So you have Stu, and then you know you have all you know his 12 kids. Either they were somehow involved in it, whether they were promoting or doing shady promotions, or and I quote shady
selling programs
refereeing or driving the ring truck.
But then all married wrestlers. Is what I was talking
all four,
about.
Yeah,
all,
right,
all four of them.
All four. So who are the four daughters marry?
So my mom married Jim Neidhart. Mm-hmm. And then Georgia married BJ.
Who did wrestle in Stampede for a brief period. Like after, kind of like, as he was already around the family, then he kind of got into wrestling for like a summer.
But he also had BJ's gym.
Yeah.
This was the famous gym in Calgary that everyone trained at.
Yeah, and then you had Allison, who was married to Ben Bassarab, who wrestled in Stampede Wrestling briefly. I mean, not
and Japan
for a few
too.
Years. And in Japan. And then you had Diana, who married Davey.
Right.
And then that gets even more complex because my Brett's wife, Julie.
Oh yeah.
She ended up marrying, she married Brett, and then her sister Michelle
married
Billington
Dynamite.
Ended up marrying Dynamite.
Yeah.
So Dynamite kid became a part of the family
as well.
He was
already like Davey's cousin or second cousin or something. So So then now they're like related in like a square. So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You have Stu. Then you had for WWE fans, it's like Brett, my dad, Davey, Dynamite, and then Owen. Mm-hmm. So then you have those five. And then after that, it's like Teddy Hart, who everybody knows takes on a whole new level of
weird,
crazy everything.
And then Teddy's worked in the WWE, was signed to developmental a couple different times.
Yeah, including in like 98. He like just 18 years old.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And then once again, like in 2006 or 7, right?
Yeah.
Ted marches to the beat of his own drum, and he's, you know, I showed you yesterday a picture of Ted coming to the ring with his Persian cats. Mm-hmm. And last year at WrestleMania, TJ makes this announcement to me that Ted's coming to meet us for dinner. And he's like, yeah, I invited Ted out. And I was like, oh, that's fine. And Ted comes in with several women, which is fine.
One was his wife, one was his girlfriend. But this isn't hidden stuff. Have you ever seen his reality show trailer?
No.
Okay, you'll see that this tour. I will show you this video.
How can you look at it on YouTube? Just it's Teddy on YouTube, Hart reality show?
Teddy Hart reality show, yes. Okay. I'm pretty sure it pops up. There's a 3-minute one.
Okay.
Unbelievable.
Okay. Yeah, and then he comes in with his cat, Mr. Money. And this cat is like this, you know, beautiful Persian cat. But I was like, okay, I didn't know Ted was bringing six people and two girlfriends and a wife and a cat. And all of a sudden, Ted's throwing the cat up in the air. It's like,
this is at 2 a.m. now.
Served wonton soup and Ted's throwing this cat. And why isn't anyone stopping us? And all of a sudden, it's like, it's time to pay for the bill. Everybody's just like.
That's the funny thing. Nobody ever stops Ted. He can just do for whatever. Yeah, her and I talk about it all the time. He can.
And nobody really ever pays the bill either when you're talking about that.
Right.
I remember I went to this is not a funny thing, but after Davey's funeral, everyone went up for Chinese food and I got invited. And at the end of the night, they passed the hat around and there's probably 20 people there. And I put in $50 and they had $73 in.
Wow.
I mean, like,
of course. Davey was extremely generous. Like when we were growing up, Davey was like,
yeah, he'd always cover like these sushi, these.
The best. He was just such a, like, he was like a big kid.
Right. But, yeah. The whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Davey and Dynamite, for as crazy as they were, I think they were more normal. My dad, I actually told this to Triple H. I think my dad is like the most normal out of all of them. And he's like, that's scary.
What's did you guys ever get to meet Dynamite at all? I mean, I know there was a kind of a real big falling out between Davey Boy and Dynamite after the British Bulldogs. Do you know the story of that or whatever happened with that?
Yeah, I know a little bit. I know that in terms of meeting him, no. I remember Robbie Brookside, who's now a trainer at the Performance Center, but I met him wrestling in England 2005. And one day and I regret it now, and not that Dynamite's – he hasn't passed away, but he was like, hey, do you want to meet Dynamite Kid? And I was like, well – in my mind, I'm painted with such, like, Davey Boy colors. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
And I was like, I heard that he's very bitter and kind of doesn't
want... You would go in there and he'd say, oh, you're a Davey Boy
guy. And then it would destroy... Like, I love watching Dynamite stuff on YouTube. So then I felt like it would maybe kind of destroy that for me. And then
never meet your hero.
So since then, like, Harry's met him and, like, he's great. And I was like... So I kind of... I don't know if I missed my chance. I'm sure I'll get another chance, hopefully. But so I didn't meet him. But I think the big... breakup was they got fired from WWE
for beating up the Rougeos.
Yeah, for the fight with the Rougeos, and
getting beat up.
Yeah,
by the
Dynamite getting jumped by Jacques.
Yeah, the story was they had some kind of they were ribbing each other or something, and Jacques jumped Dynamite with a roll of quarters.
Yeah,
and punched out his teeth.
Dynamite had like a cigarette in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so then they were wrestling in Stampede and they were wrestling in Japan, and the story that I was told is that one day they're in the locker room and then Vince was there. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want you guys back. And Davey said, okay. And Dynamite said, hell no. Mm. Not quite in those words.
Right.
And then I think he was very mad that Davey had gone.
Davey said, forget it. If you're not going, I'm going.
Yeah, and Davey, I mean, had to make, I guess, the move for his family to go. And at that time, Dynamite was really beaten up. So I think Davey was doing a lot of the workload. And maybe earlier when they were a tag team was the opposite way.
Yeah.
But at this point, I think Davey was doing the workload. And so without Davey, now Dynamite, that's when they brought in Johnny Smith.
Oh, the new British Bulldogs.
Yeah, so then Johnny Smith's the young guy doing like most of the work and tagging Dynamite for the hot tag or whatever. But
that was
so
in Japan, I think.
Yeah,
right?
In all Japan. So I think that's the big riff at the time was because he felt Davey just kind of betrayed him and left. And Diana's very... She can be like a shrewd businesswoman, and she had the intellect to trademark the name the British Bulldog in terms of wrestling. Or so Davey
owned the name.
So then that was another big riff with Davey and Dynamite.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately and sadly, they never
Really?
Never patched up. Never.
Before Davey passed away, they never patched up.
Never.
That's a drag, man, because that's one of the greatest tag teams of all time.
Yeah. I mean, how many people did they influence? And like?
Oh, dude. My friend and I, in about probably 1986, 87, we used to hang outside the Winnipeg Arena and wear the tightest shirts we could. And we both had like big arms.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like
we work your upper body. Muscles, right?
Upper body business, kid. And we used to wait outside and think like, man, imagine if the British Bulldogs saw us and took us under their wing and took us on the road and we became their proteges and they taught us everything they knew. So we always used to wait outside, like, are they going to see us? And I only imagine, like, imagine if they would have taken us under their wing. We would have been drunk and messed up on pills.
And the thing is, they're a tag team that there's a lot of performers, but there's the special ones that almost transcend time. Like, you could take the Bulldogs and put them into those TLC matches.
And sure.
It'd be amazing. You couldn't take, like, other tag teams, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
And
couldn't
do that.
Take Beefcake and Valentine.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Right. You could take the Bulldogs and put them at that time. You could put them, like, a couple years ago, or, I mean, a year ago with, like, the Shield and Wyatt.
That's a great point. You could put them with the Usos tonight or whoever, right?
And it would be awesome.
Yeah.
So, like, it's a shame that they never rehashed.
Yeah.
And they are cousins. They're family, and it's just...
Just on a personal level.
I know, and also, like, something... crazy where like Dynamite went and beat up Davey's brother one time pretty
in
bad.
England
yeah
Lots
so
weird
so
stuff.
A lot of like weird things where Dynamite took it very very personal
and then Owen's wedding didn't was bad because that turned into that's gonna epitomize the crazy hearts because Owen was getting Owen was getting married. He was you know, obviously it was gonna be this big family wedding. Everybody was at the Hart House. Well,
I know the story the way Davey told me it.
There was fighting with the mother-in-laws. My grandmother Helen Hart wanted. She was from New York and she was very stuffy and, you know, prim and proper, despite the fact that there was nothing but wrestlers at her house that were, you know, under the Giants downstairs in the kitchen. My grandmother is like, you know, reading Vogue upstairs in her bedroom, but
Stu's making breakfast for everyone.
Yeah, with a spatula that's being used for two different things.
I gotta talk about
everyone
that.
Everyone has that story.
But you know, it's funny because like, so there was this fight with the mother-in-laws over whether they were going to serve, you know, creme brulee for dessert or have Jello with fruit in it from Safeway. and then I think did Dynamite so break Bruce's
okay yeah, you, so what the story is that
somebody's jaw was broken.
There's a heel van and a babyface van that the Stampede shows everybody rides in the van,
right?
So I guess like the heel van, imagine this now, but the windshield's broken. There's not a windshield. And they're driving wherever the hell they're...
Why is there not a windshield?
It got broken. I don't know.
And they just never bothered fixing it?
And so for like this loop... they got it fixed, but for this loop, it broke the night before and they're just having to drive to whatever town.
Right.
And so like as they're driving, they're getting hit with bugs. Like think about a windshield that you're driving on the highway, right? So then the story is that... this was maybe the babyface van because Davey and Dynamite are in this van, but Bruce is in a different van. Mm-hmm. Bruce in maybe the heel van or something. He snuck in because he didn't want to be in the one without the windshield. So the story is that it got back to Davey and Dynamite that Bruce was like laughing at them that they had to drive. So Dynamite's had enough, and Davey too. And Davey told me they both are like kind of going around this car to get Bruce. Mm-hmm. And Davey told me Dynamite just kind of got to him first and broke his jaw the day before
Owen's wedding.
And Bruce was the best man.
Oh, wow.
So, oh no, was that Owen? That's not Owen's wedding.
No, that was Owen's wedding.
Because Owen's a young kid and he goes to try to fight.
No, that must have been another time because Bruce
the
couldn't.
The time Dynamite broke Bruce's jaw.
Well, Dynamite and Bruce had a lot of issues. We won't get into some of them because they're not PG, but. But I remember that because my mom didn't want to go to the wedding because Davey was like, well, I'm not going to the wedding. Like there was a bunch of infighting. So it turned into family feud. So my mom and Davey were very close. My mom's like, well, Davey's not going. I'm not going. And then, you know, so like, everybody
it always
started
turns to
take,
that where there's like some split in the middle and then it tears off.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you can see in the picture, Bruce still ended up being the best man. You can see in the pictures, Bruce didn't have his mouth open in the pictures. He was wearing a gray suit and they were all posed on the front lawn. Everybody's got these glares on their face. I have to show you this picture. I'll have to get like Brett to send it to me. But it turned into like, and then Brett was like, well, Bruce, you know, it turned into this like,
yeah, yeah.
It,
Well, if Bruce isn't going, then I am going.
Yeah. It basically turned into like people taking sides, and the mother-in-laws were fighting, and all Owen wanted was just to get married because Owen and Martha were like high school sweethearts. Mm-hmm. So that was like, you know, Family Feud. And then I remember there being a lot of fighting at the wedding because somebody, I think George, my Aunt Georgia, caught somebody putting their cigarette out on the floor, and then she went and told, like, it was just like.
Which is funny, like, of all the craziness of the hearts, probably the ultimate sin out of anything is
anything.
Smoking cigarettes.
If you smoke cigarettes, you might be
out of the family. Yeah.
Oh, just smoking at all. Like, smoking cigarettes.
Cigarettes.
Yeah, okay.
Other stuff.
Why?
My grandfather just didn't, like, he had a real thing about cigarettes. So once, like, somebody tried to smoke in the, like, out of all the things, dynamite freaking broke Bruce's jaw. There's, you know, the mother-in-laws are fighting.
Settled, right. It is no problem. That's just boys.
It was like, yeah, my mom's like, I'm not going. And there was so much fighting leading up to the wedding. And then it was like this ultimate fight broke out over the cigarette butt in the carpet. And it was just like a big, big ordeal. But, you know, there was lots of different, that's the thing. That's why there's so much craziness in the family is because, well, one, there's 12 kids.
Right.
And everybody's kind of, I feel like when you break it down, everybody was like vying for my grandfather's attention. And he could only discipline everybody so much.
Dole out so much attention to 12 kids and 12 spouses and brothers-in-law.
Because everybody kept marrying wrestlers and like, so it did kind of get.
Cousins, I mean, there's 36 cousins.
Smith was the craziest. And you think about how my grandfather had to tame Smith. I told you the other day, you know, the Hart House is on a hill. It's in this beautiful neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of the most, you know, fancy neighborhoods in Calgary, Coach Hill. And there's a bird. It was a pheasant that was killed. Okay, leave the damn bird alone. Smith goes down.
This is during my era, too. I was around for the
pheasant. You were there because it was whatever.
So there's a what on the road?
A dead bird, a pheasant.
A pheasant was dead.
Smith felt like it was fresh enough that he grabbed the pheasant and then brought it into my grandfather's house. Didn't really announce it to my grandfather until after it was cooked that it was something he found on the road and didn't want to see this bird go to waste.
Yeah.
And then proceeded to put mandarin oranges from the can from Safeway around the pheasant. And then
it's so funny because Smith would like do nothing, but then over this random like pheasant, here he is trying to prepare it like it's this grand feast.
And it's like Smith could, it's like
he never does this, but then one day he's got a pheasant cooked with mandarin oranges around it.
Yeah, it's like,
so did Stu eat it?
No. Ted's mom made the big save. She,
I think she threw it in the dump.
She accidentally drops it on the ground, and the dogs come and eat it. And Smith was livid that. We lived at the guest house, and one time, Smith, I hear like a little noise on the
Chris
door.
That. I was in the shower, by the way.
I opened the door, and then he'd put a note on our door, lost, some wing-tipped bat.
I told Chris about that, too.
There's some dead bat that he found.
In the bushes.
That he put in like a little baggie and froze it.
For what reason?
And then somebody stole the bat out of the freezer.
So he put the note on a lost frozen bat?
Yes.
Who took my frozen bat?
I remember as a kid, maybe like 16-ish, but this ring truck that they used to have that probably didn't really work, but Smith was driving it back from BC or Smith's friend, but hit a porcupine and put it on the back of the truck. And like for at least like 3 weeks of the summer, there was this dead porcupine sitting on the back of this ring truck. And I just remember thinking like, what is? And finally like, maybe Stu or somebody finally got rid of it. But that's like, for whatever reason, now that we're sitting here thinking about something about Smith and these like roadkill and like very weird. Bizarre.
Well, I thought, you know, I'm glad you corrected me, TJ, because I would seriously hate to have you testifying against me in court.
Just as a quick segue, it's funny. We were talking last night and it said like, I don't know anything about wrestling trivia. I just can't remember. But Cody and TJ, you guys know everything.
Oh,
you can remember everything. You guys remember every little detail. Like if I ever want a wrestling question or something, I know exactly the man to ask.
What's funny is I had a dealing with Shawn Michaels and like helping whatever. He would kept pulling me aside, and eventually I told him, "Hey, Brett was asking kind of who's helping me along on the road," and I mentioned Shawn, and then. So I was telling Sean.
So when you first came here, for example, Sean was helping you out.
My first night, I had a dark match with Jamie Noble. And Sean, like, brawler came and found me and said, Sean's looking for you. And Sean came and found me and was like, had a lot of complimentary things to say and gave me a couple things.
Right. So Sean's kind of taking you under his wing.
Yeah, like right away, which, like, you know, Sean's one of my, especially in the Hart family, it's almost like taboo at the time, but he's one of my favorite. He's my favorite of all time.
Yeah, me too.
So I was like, really taken aback by it, and I was kind of telling Brett, and then I told that to Sean, and then like his whole demeanor changed a little.
And this is when Sean and Brett hated each other. They hadn't talked for years. So what did you say to Sean?
So I told Sean that Brett, that I told Brett that he was one of the guys really helping me out. And then he was like, I didn't know that you're from there. And then...
Really? Yeah, he didn't know you were a Heart,
quote
unquote.
Then we started talking. We got pretty deeper. Sean was like, not crying, but like I could see his eyes. Like he's like,
wow.
He was very crazy. He was like, you know, sometimes he's like, sometimes I almost just want to like show up at Brett's doorstep, let him punch me out. But if we can talk afterwards, that'd be all that I want. And I was like, wow, this thing is like really, really deep. And so Natty had mentioned it to Brett, and Brett was like obsessed to talk to me about what did Sean say. And there was like a lot of paranoia on maybe on both ends. But like, remember I took a pre-workout, I was going to the gym, and I was like, okay, I'll talk to Brett maybe like 10 minutes because the conversation wasn't that long. Brett talked to me for like over an hour, and he was like, I just don't trust it. Like if he gives you his number and I call him and then he hangs up on me,
he'll drive me nuts.
Then he got me.
You're right.
I said, I don't know, Brett. I don't know him the way you know him, but he was very, very, seemed very serious. So anyway, I ended up getting Brett's number and giving it to Sean. And not too long ago at NXT, Sean just, I think, released a new book.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, Tyson, I want to ask you something. Did you give me Brett's number or did I give you my number? And I was like, oh, I gave you Brett's number. He's like, okay, that's what I thought. I was writing it in my book. And I was like, and they mentioned it on the Brett and Sean DVD too. Sean mentions that I, which is really cool.
So you kind of brokered the deal. Like, did he ever call Brett? Do you know? Or
So I think like same thing. Their relationship is, I don't think they could have spoken on the phone. You know, I think they had to see
each other.
But I think Sean's very smart and he knew Brett's itinerary. So when Brett's flying to be the guest host of Raw, that first return,
wow,
I think maybe Sean knew he was in the air. So he called, so it'd go straight to voicemail and just left the message. So there's at least like that little bit of peace going
gotcha.
In.
Like, I don't want to talk to you. I just need to tell you this.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So you kind of helped help bring those two back
to peace.
Yeah, at least
like in my own little part of like.
Yeah. That's amazing, man. Yeah, because that I mean, obviously was a huge thing. I mean, how was that for the family when the big screw job went down? I mean, how'd you guys feel?
Yeah, I remember it really well because obviously, and that's the thing with Sean and Brett. It's like you said that Sean, you know, is one of your favorites of all time. Like Brett is, if you look at Brett, some people say that he's one of, you know, like people.
For me, Sean is one, Brett is two.
Yeah, they can switch depending on like, what match I just watched.
Yeah, I think that's like, you know, when I look at Brett, it's like a lot of. Even though female, you know, I guess divas, it's just different sometimes. But I really like, I see a lot of Brett's facials and his selling, and sometimes he'll just do the smallest little thing, and I'll be like, that, like, how did he do that? You know?
Right.
Like, you just feel the emotions more than the moves or anything else. And so I think Brett is very deep, and you know, we were saying
I think he was very ahead of, like, the whole realism.
The real era.
Rather than, like, the cartoony stuff.
Sure.
I think if you watch his stuff now, it translates to. Where
it's
they want to go
when
today.
He did have to do the cartoon stuff because it was that era, it never really fit. He never really did it anyways, but the couple times when they had them like singing on Pile Driver, if you only knew, it was just it's like when the Bulldogs had to do it, like, singing, like what
they were. Brett was very ahead of his time as far as being like reality based
and that sort
of thing. And like the screw job, I think it like really shattered Brett because you know. Brett believed that he was the best. Sean believed that he was the best. And it was one of those things that, like, Brett had just a different, you know, style. Sean had a different style. But both of them believed so much in what they were. And they were at different places. Even Sean says, I wasn't, like, you know, he wasn't.
I remember seeing them at a live event in Calgary in, like, 94. And they were, like, friends.
Well, that's the thing I think that really hurt Brett is, A, Sean and Brett were friends. They were turned against each other in a lot of ways by Vince. And Triple H and I talked about this on my podcast. Vince used to – he'll never come out and say it, but he liked when guys had real heat.
And that competition.
Because
like,
that made for better
matches.
Yeah.
Like, and I know that with myself
you
even. Know,
sure. Like, you and I don't like each other. Like, I mean, listen, I don't like Tyson, but when I go in the ring, I'm going to show this guy – I am a million times better.
Exactly.
You're feeling the same way.
Yes.
Exactly.
And I think so both of them kind of got turned against each other unwillingly.
Yep.
And then I really believe, because I have the same type of relationship with Vince, that like, he was like a father figure to Brett.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when Vince kind of betrayed him, I think that really cut him to the bone because it's like your father turning on you. Like, how can you do this? This is not a wrestling promoter.
Yep.
This is not some. Let me twirling my mustache. I'm gonna get you. It's like
this is my
you know the guy. I respect.
I mean, like Vince had flown to Calgary before. There's footage of like he and Brett like sitting on grass talk. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, like, Vince and Brett had a super deep relationship. And that's the thing, is I think it really devastated Bret, because he just had devoted so much of his life to WWE, and especially to Vince, and having that strong, like, fatherly connection that you'd, you know, be willing to sacrifice so much. So I think it really, like, definitely after the screw job happened, I think it really hurt Bret deeply. And I think, you know, you look at, like, things that happened to Bret after, like, his stroke and stuff like that, like, you know,
kind of started him on a downward spiral, because there was a concussion in there too.
Yeah. And it was like, stress, because that's what they say, like, with strokes, a lot of the time it's very much stress related, and you hold on to all that, like, sadness and anger, and, like, it really can hurt you. That bad energy can hurt you. And
I think that's almost what, with the stroke, and then he got a phone call from Vince
after the stroke, wishing him well, he's in the hospital. Yes.
And I think that lifted that train of, like, where Bret started to let go of a lot of stuff.
But in order for Bret and Shawn to be, like, when you look at the level of performers that they were, like, in order for them to be that good, they have to be that passionate. And to be that passionate, you almost have to get to that level of obsession and craziness, where it's like, Shawn believed that he was the best, Bret believed that he was the best, and they both had this, like, you know, and that's why their matches were so, like, you look back at, like, I mean, really ahead of its time, the Iron Man match.
Unbelievable.
Timeless.
Can you imagine a 60-minute match at WrestleMania now? Nobody would have it. Fans wouldn't go for it.
I was there live that day. Owen flew me there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so earlier in the morning, I saw Shawn. We were eating breakfast, and then Shawn came in, and Diana said, "Oh, you excited for tonight?" And he said, "I'm really nervous. Really nervous about, like, keeping everybody entertained." And I was like, "Shawn Michaels gets nervous." I was like 16. I'd had one match under my belt, and I was like, "So it's not just me."
Yeah,
Shawn Michaels gets nervous. Nervous. And so sitting there, I saw the scoreboard. It was this old, like, high school style scoreboard. And you see 60 minutes, and I was thinking, yeah, this
is a long time.
And next thing you know, the whole time I'm on the edge of my seat. I've watched that match probably 30 times.
Really?
Yeah. I love it. There's a lot of art and a lot of, like, you can see that competition. And, like, for one full hour, it's unbelievable. It's
the old school way of building that match. Because that was, you know, a 60-minute match was kind of the norm, you know, in Flair's day. I mean, Flair will tell you he's probably done, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 60-minute matches. The same with Dory Funk and Terry and, you know, Briscoes and all that sort of stuff. So there was an old school way of building that.
Yeah.
And they really kind of took that into the modern era. Yeah. Let's talk about, you mentioned a couple times Owen, how Owen flew you out there and stuff. And I had only two or three meetings with Owen, and all three of them were, like, amazing, great guys, so much fun. How was he as a guy?
Well, I think because he was the baby of the family, he was, like, the most lighthearted, and, like, you know, he was just notorious for pulling pranks on people. And I think that's actually where TJ and Harry get their pranking from. And I'm not going to reveal too much, TJ, because we still need to make prank phone calls to a few people. But
and that's also a Calgary thing, too, is the pranking. A lot of ribs and
pranks. I remember reading in your book about prank phone calls, and as I'm reading it, burst out
laughing. I burst out laughing, especially with your book is really funny. But anyway, you might have a little Owen in you.
Because coming from Calgary, that was just the way it was. Tell me a prank that Owen pulled. Did you ever see one, or is the stories?
This isn't even a great one, but, like, one time he called Stu's, and Stu had two different phone numbers, and two phones were right beside each other in the stairwell.
Yeah. Okay.
And at least one of them was listed. Anybody could
call.
I mean, fans would call all day long and ask if Bret's there. It's like, no, you see that he's the WWE champion.
They would call Stu's house.
You can believe it, he doesn't live with his father anymore. Smith still lives here. Bret doesn't live here. And so one time I answer the phone, and it's someone pretending to be Walter Payton. And I was like, I'd received enough of these calls at this point. I was like 14. So I'm playing along with, oh, hey, Walter, what's going on? And, like, talking, and then finally the Walter voice, which I don't even know if it sounded anything like Walter.
It is a Walter voice,
exactly, completely stops. He goes, oh, hey, TJ, this is Owen. Can you put my dad on the phone? And I was like, I felt like such an idiot that, like, here I am thinking I'm pulling some prank, too, on some guy trying to play, and then it's Owen.
Owen knew how to, like, stir the pot a little bit and get people kind of, like, you know, fighting with each other, and I think... I'm sure my grandfather knew most of the time it was Owen, but, like, you'll probably know the details of this, but didn't Owen put a bunch of farm animals from the Goblins into
Owen and Davey put the animals from like, the Godwin's never... thing into Vince's office one day.
During a pay-per-view. I think it was like the...
Maybe like the hog pen match or something.
And so they put them all in Vince's office. And then I think Hunter told me that they couldn't really prove who did it. So they couldn't like... But I think Vince was like, Owen!
They even
like,
did an article in WWE Magazine maybe not too long ago about the animals being put in Vince's office with like the door shut. You have all these animals... I'm sure some stuff went down. You know?
Yeah,
so,
like it's.
I heard the one where Owen called Stu as I think it was Reg Parks.
Yes, yeah, and that's one of Brett's favorites.
Like, yeah, and he was imitating Reg Parks as an old timer and was kind of talking to Stu about how, you know, Stu, you were never really all that tough and you couldn't really stretch anybody, but it's all just a facade and it's bullshit. And Stu was getting more and more mad.
Very worked Brett up.
Like, Reg, if you think you're so tough, why don't you come over and try me? And it's Owen on the other end messing with his dad.
And I know, like, I'd heard a few others, like, just simple ones, like, but Owen was at one point riding with the Ultimate Warrior. And
there's a strange mix.
Yeah, and so Owen's Blue Blazer at the time. And they're going to go into a hotel, and there's all these fans in the lobby. But a Warrior without his paint on and with just like a hat on. A
ponytail or something.
Yeah, might be able to kind of get free. And he's like, hey, Owen, let's not cause any, you know, bring any
Brouhaha,
attention.
Yeah.
Okay, no problem. As Owen's about to walk on, he throws on his Blue Blazer mask. So now you have a guy, Warrior size, trying to like be all discreet. And you have Owen walking through this lobby where there's all these fans of the Blue Blazer mask. So you see Blue Blazer, you assume the guy who's bigger than him with him is a wrestler. Eventually you're going to figure out that Warrior and it's going to turn to mayhem. Just things like that where Owen always like, oh, okay, if you told him something in a pranking way, he would do the opposite.
And to this day, Harry has brought back some of Owen's friends into our lives. No names mentioned. But, Chris, you know exactly who I'm talking about.
It's funny because I always call it Owen's last rib on the boys. Because Owen was, I'm not going to say he was cheap, but he was
very,
very
frugal.
Thrifty. Yeah, frugal. That's the word.
Frugal.
So he would go on the road and have fans pick him. Like, we rent cars and rent hotels. Owen would have fans pick him up, drive him to the towns, and then he would stay at their house just to save money. And when Owen passed away, there was this whole legion of like Owen fanatics, Owen followers, Owen disciples that would come and say, "Hey, Chris, do you want to ride?" Like, you know, because I'm from Calgary. I was like, I don't know any of these people.
Right.
A lot of them were kind of strange, but God bless them, Owen. They were friends. But
right.
Like,
and Owen's big selling point, he always like, "No, it's great because nothing beats a home cooked meal." And I was like, "Well." And free 99 helps too.
Well,
know.
And then Brett would be like
free 99.
Yeah, Brett would. You always say, yeah, nothing's ever free. But
no.
Brett would be like, you know, Owen needed to understand that it was important to pay for a good bed to sleep in and have a meal. But Owen would get these rides with these strange people that their car would break down or that he'd be sleeping in the back, like in their house. And then Harry, for whatever reason, is very, very much like my Uncle Ross in the best way, and like kind of like Owen in the sense that he's prankster, practical joker, and very frugal. And Harry's brought
and he
back.
He has this obsession of like seeking
weird
these
friends.
People out. He
Harry wants
Harry.
Weird,
yeah,
weird,
loves,
weird
Harry's,
friends.
Harry's nuts too.
And he loves being entertained by.
I think that's what Owen would be entertained by these really,
really weird,
people
weird people.
That were his friends, but also kind of like gave, like, he not only get a free home cooked meal, free bed, but he got free entertainment.
Well, Harry had one of Owen's friends. I'm not going to bring names into it, but Chris, you know who I'm talking about. And he's one of Owen's most famous friends. And Harry ended up reconnecting with this guy on Facebook. And next, when we were the Hart Dynasty, you know, in between Harry impersonating Mike Rotundo, Ricky Steamboat, and Arn Anderson.
All dead on.
Amazing. Like, once again, you mentioned Walter Payton.
Yeah.
Who can do a Mike Rotundo imitation?
I know. Harry can do Mike Rotundo better than Mike.
What he sounds like. Harry would say Mike Rotundo or Steamboat.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, oh my gosh, that sounds exactly like Big Show.
Yeah.
I should have Harry on just to
do
imitations.
Oh my gosh, you have to have
Harry. I've always said if the company or somebody wanted Harry to be an exact character – and they had this idea
it's
and they showed
crazy.
It to him, he would be it 100%, and there would be no doubt about it.
Harry does the most incredible, not that I even want to say this, but the most incredible impersonations. He does a really great Carl DeMarco impersonation.
DeMarco, the head, old head of
including like coughing.
But Harry brought one of Owen's old friends back into our lives during the Hart Dynasty days, and the guy started like stalking us.
Uh-huh.
And Harry got the guy front row tickets, and he's like, Natty, he's going to give us a ride. I'm like, I don't want to ride, Harry. I want to pay for my own car. I don't want this guy around us.
Crazy people.
The guy's knocking on our door. Next thing you know, this guy's telling us about his sex life. And I'm like, And Harry's like, what's going on?
And Harry brings another friend. Harry
wants to know details.
And Harry brought another friend over, and then he got like he didn't make it, but then they were all drinking. And then those two friends started fighting, and Harry just entertained by the whole thing, recording some of it and telling me about
it. Harry invited me over to a barbecue one time. The house, and I went over there, and there was no barbecue. There was nothing to eat. There was nothing to drink. I was like, this is the worst barbecue ever.
Undercooked chicken and overcooked hamburgers.
I never, they were gone by the time. Yeah, yeah. They must have made like two.
I couldn't believe that you showed up to the barbecue, because I was just joking with you.
Well, I you know, I was awesome. Wanted to check it out too, out of curiosity.
But you didn't get food poisoning or anything from that?
He didn't eat. It was all gone by then.
No, and I didn't eat either, and Harry did, and he got a touch of the food poisoning.
Yeah, and Harry, I was like, Harry, free is not free.
Yeah. So let's talk about Stu for a bit. I mean, obviously one of the most famous characters in wrestling. You know, we talk about who knows Mike Rotunda's voice. Everyone knows Stu Hart's voice. Yeah. Everyone can imitate Stu, whether they met him or not. And there's so many stories from, you know, Brett's time frame and Owen's time frame. You guys are a generation later. Stu was alive for, I think he just passed away maybe 10 years ago?
About 10 years
2003
ago. 2003? Yep. 10 or 11 years. Yeah, something like that.
So, I mean, obviously you had a long relationship with your grandfather. Yeah. And you as well, yeah, yeah. TJ. So what? Tell us a little bit about that, about Stu.
Yeah, Stu is definitely the ultimate... the ultimate of the crazies. But and so, like, my grandfather, like, I think about him every day because he was such a unique person. He was, you know, somebody that my grandfather had a really hard upbringing. He lived in Saskatchewan. He actually at one point ended up being homeless. And
they lived in a field where he had to put rocks in the bottom of his sleeping bag to keep warm in the middle of a Canadian winter.
Yep, and sleep in between dogs.
Which I think, and then Stu became like, he loved animals.
Oh, okay.
Like, undying loyalty to animals because...
To live. He actually killed rabbits and stuff, and like, the dogs kept him warm. And his parents, I don't know all the particulars, but for whatever reason, at one point, my grandfather was pretty much by himself, and he just had his sister there, and... very young age, and he ended up taking up like refuge at the YMCA just kind of to keep warm. Mm-hmm. And ended up getting into amateur wrestling and then became this incredible amateur wrestler, and was really, really involved with sports and
played in the CFL.
And just, you know, he just was an incredible person. But he always was very, very, very compassionate. And when he was young and struggling, I remember my grandmother would always tell the story of one of his uncles not really helping him. And he reached out saying, like, I'm homeless. I need help. Like, I need someone to, like, take me in. And they kind of ignored him. And then when my grandfather became very, very successful and, you know, more well-known, later on that uncle kind of reached out to him. And my grandfather took him, like, embraced him with open arms. And he was just unconditionally loving. No matter who you were, somebody tried to break into the Hart House in the 70s.
Yeah, Brad and tells the story too.
Because my grandfather never, ever locked his doors. He was like, well, if people want to come in, they can come in. Mm-hmm. Never, ever, ever, ever lock the doors of the Hart House. That's like...
I don't think so. Some of the doors didn't have locks.
No, I don't think they did.
Some of the windows didn't go up. Yeah,
because the house was built in 1902.
Okay.
So there was four, you know, stories to the Hart House, and it was a hospital in the First World War, and and this guy tried to break into the house, and my grandfather caught him, brought him up into the kitchen, and they had tea and talked.
He was stealing a car. The guy was stealing a car. Brett tells the story, and it was wintertime, and he's trying to drive the car up the.
So
he couldn't get up.
It was like an old Cadillac.
Stu thought it was one of the kids, and so he goes out, and it's this guy, and then he ends up bringing the guy in, and they're having tea in the kitchen or something.
Yeah, I think he did stretch him in the basement first.
Of course.
I think he, like, put some shoot holds on him in the basement and then brought him up for dinner after.
Which those, at the time they're happening to you, are not fun.
But I remember, like,
I've been stretched.
Yeah,
many of
a few times.
Times
by Stu, and every time is like.
So when you get stretched by Stu, I mean, Stu's probably 75 years old at this time. I mean, I remember he would say, like, let me show you this move. So if you gave him your arm, which was the dumbest thing you could do, he would kill you.
Yeah.
Did you let him do it, or were you just rolling around with him? Or what were you doing where he stretched you?
So a lot of times, how it would start, especially the times in the kitchen where it just becomes kind of an impromptu. This display of hold is that he's kind of talking with somebody else, and I'm just kind of around, and then he starts with the, there's this one hold, and he's talking to you, but he starts grabbing me, and then it's like, I'm like a small kid, or, you know, I'm 16, but look like about 10, and so you don't really do anything but be the demo
Stu Hart,
and try, like, the whole thing is to try not to, like, you don't want to yell, but it's like, and some of the holds you can't. Some of
if
the holds...
you didn't scream, you'd be better off getting like. Yeah. If you screamed,
yeah,
they would put it on harder.
And then you would hold it, and he was such a master of it that like, you would feel like, okay, I'm gonna pass out, and then like, somehow he would know and let go, and then. And then, but he had this whole series where like one went to the neck. So one's like your head and neck, and then one's your arm and your shoulder, which then leads to your chin, which then leads to like something where like it's taking the wind out of your stomach. And like, so like as my like neck, and I feel like I'm about to pass out. Now it's something on my arm. And then, so like, then
he
it's
wouldn't
a
let go. He would just transfer the pain.
And it's funny because Brett talked about, or Brett always tells the story, but when he was training for that Ironman match with Sean, he's like, you know, Sean had this great video and this is just so funny. Cause like, just, you know, it's funny hearing it after the fact, but Brett was like, Sean had this great video and he's, you know, training with,
Jose Lothario
and he's just doing all this crazy stuff. And he looks he's
handstand pushups on this bar. And he's like,
and Brett's like, I'm getting my ass kicked by my 75-year-old father in the dungeon. And he's like, they've got video footage of me gingerly running along the ice.
It's winter time. So you can't really run. You're going to slip. So.
But, and then, and one last thing, going back to Stu and the, stretching, my grandfather in his wallet, he always, this is just a known fact in the Hard House, in my grandfather's wallet for most of his life, he had a picture of not my grandmother, not of his kids. He had a picture of a guy named Luther Lindsay. And I was just telling Mark Henry this story the other day. It's the only person that ever tapped my grandfather out. It's this really sturdy shooter named Luther Lindsay. And it's this guy, like, if you looked at it, he kind of looks a little bit like Biggie Langston. And my grandfather has a picture of him in his wallet, in his trunks, in his wrestling trunks. And it's like, if you were somebody that found that wallet, like if Stu had accidentally left his wallet at a bar, you're like, this guy's really weird. Like, he's got this big guy with a pair of wrestling trunks. Where is his wife? Where is his kids? My grandfather spoke like Luther Lindsay might as well have been God.
Because he took him down.
Because he tapped Stu out. And so that was like, my grandfather was just like,
he probably kept in there too to look at, like, you know, for motivation, like someday. You know, wow. It's funny you mentioned about having the doors not open at the Hard House. I told you the story the other day. It's in one of my books where I went there right before they sold it. Now it's a museum, right? Or it's a
historical site.
Okay, so at one point they were going to tear it down. Benoit said, you know, you should go over there and you know, it might be the last time. So he had gone in there earlier in the day and. We were going to try and go together, but we couldn't, whatever. So I went.
He filmed his DVD?
Yeah, he filmed some stuff in his DVD.
We lived at the guest house, so I could see, like, okay, the camera crews.
But I went there, and I knocked on the door, and it's one of those things like a horror movie. You knock on the door, and the door opens. Dunk, dunk. So I walk in, and, you know, I see the kitchen and all the place, and go downstairs into the dungeon, and, like, you know, everyone talks about the dungeon, and I'm sure. You might be thinking it's like the performance center. So there's like this place with all these rings and this. The ring was probably about 3 inches off the ground.
Yeah.
It didn't even have a proper apron or skirt on it. And there was pipes and.
There was no ropes. It's just walls.
There was no ropes, just walls. Yeah. The walls were the ropes.
And one little window.
Yeah, and a couple little like weightlifting things. But I remember the pipes from the furnace were all around too. Yeah. A very small little area. And so I'm just looking around, and then I'm walking back up the stairs, and the stairs had a door at the top, and the door flew open, and I see this like this shady figure, and I was convinced it's Leatherface. Like, it's a serial killer. I'm dead. It's like when you go, I shouldn't have went in the house. Just don't go in the house. And I'm like, and then throws a human head at me. I'm like, no. And then I realize it's not a human head. It's a big wad of sheets. And this isn't Leatherface. It's a fat guy wearing dress pants. And the sheets fly by me. It smells like cat piss. It's basically. And I look up and it's Smith. He's like, cat's pissed on the sheets again. Close the door and leaves. And I never saw him again. I didn't know he was in the house. I was in there for half an hour. And I don't know where he went to.
That's
after.
Why I love your books, because I can hear your voice in your books. Like, it's like I can hear, I can feel you in the book. But no, that was the door to the dungeon. So where you were, I know this for a fact. You were in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You were in the kitchen. You opened up the door to the dungeon.
Right.
The dungeon stairs were all metal. They hurt like hell to walk down because it was all metal. It's all industrial.
Like something you'd see in like a torture chamber.
And it's so dark, so that when the door does open, there's that light.
Yeah, that's what that was exactly like the movie.
Shadows.
And many drunk people at those Christmas parties my grandmother would throw, like, they would always fall down those stairs of the dungeon. But to the left of the dungeon was a crematorium. So the Hart House, yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
Oh, yeah, because the house was a hospital in the First World War. Okay. So when you walk down the stairs of the dungeon, it's the very, like, basement. To the left was a crematorium, which my grandfather would make my grandmother chicken. He'd always make her special fried chicken down there.
In the crematorium?
And you're right where the crematorium room was. Like, he had a deep fryer.
Would he use the crematorium?
No. But like, he had a deep fryer next to the crematorium. But you know where it was because you tried to steal at one point a steak of my grandmother's and then you got caught. But we won't get into that.
That's so, not at all true.
Well, you asked her if you could borrow, have a steak and she said no.
Something like that. But I didn't steal it.
Oh. Okay, forget it, DJ. Not a piece. So never mind. I'm sorry I asked or said that. So anyway, to the left, crematorium. To the right, the dungeon. And then behind that was this room. And I don't want to – I mean, should we mention where Bob
– The Bob Johnson room?
Did you ever meet Bob Johnson?
Yeah, Bob Johnson's kind of the historian of Calgary Stampede at this
point. Well, he also, like, he was somebody that my grandfather – you know, my grandfather was very compassionate. And Bob was going through a hard time in his life. So Bob – behind the dungeon, Bob kind of stayed in this one room, and he stayed there with a dog named Lana Kia that had a really wounded nipple.
There's a room on the side there where it's Jim's old, like, Oakland Raiders.
Oh, my dad, when he played for the treadmill. Raiders, he brought his treadmill down there.
It's like a treadmill that it's not electronic at all. So, like, the more speed you go, the more it just keeps gaining.
It's like one of those old school 1970s treadmills.
It's so loud, and then this room's, like, hollow. And then Bob slept in another room attached to that.
Yeah.
But, like, we would train in the dungeon, and then we'd end with, like, these little sprints on the treadmill. It's so hard to breathe in that room if you're just sitting in it, let alone running on this treadmill.
Bob would be in there with Lana.
And Bob would be sleeping with.
Now, guys, like, everyone's listening at home. Like, this is all in Stu's house. There's a crematorium. There's an old treadmill. There's people living there that you're not really sure who's living there.
People just came because sometimes people would have nowhere to live.
Well, there's a guy who was living there, Neil.
Neil. Oh, God.
He's living there. And Brett had given Helen a Bart Simpson shirt. And so she loved it.
It was like her prized possession.
Because it was from Brett. The one day she sees Neil, who's living there in the office across from the dungeon.
At this time, experimenting with makeup, but we won't get into that.
Drawing on eyebrows and things of that nature. But he tanning.
Of course he was. Why wouldn't he be?
Tanning on the lawn in the summer with just a sock. But
TJ.
So here he is that in the kitchen with the Bart Simpson shirt. And Helen's like devastated. So then, like, I don't know if she brought it up or maybe she mentions his stew, whatever. So finally they talk about Neil moving out. And Neil, who's living there for free, says he has he's like, I'll move out, but I need a pair of shoes first. So they somehow agree that they're gonna buy him a pair of Nike Shocks, and then he's gonna be on his way.
Yeah.
So to get him to move out of their house where he's staying for free, they're gonna buy him out.
But she wanted her shirt back as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Very adamant.
So, oh, because he stole her shirt.
Yeah. So they buy the shoes.
Neil was a thief.
They buy the shoes, and he lived with a friend for like a week or two. And then he was back in living down in the dungeon area.
Wow.
And because, like, they wouldn't – like, Helen never really came down there at that stage of her life, didn't really come down to the dungeon. She'd be on the main floor and then her room. And same with Stu would only come down, like Natty said, to make Helen the wings that she liked. So, like, this Neil guy, he got the shoes and he still lived there 2 weeks later.
Right. He might still be living there as far as
I know. He kind of looked like, from a distance, if you didn't know, he looked sort of like he had the dark hair, like Brett's.
He did try to keep a Bret Hart look going.
He tried to keep a Bret-esque look going. Now, as far as sunbathing on the lawn, nude, at the Hart House, like
I said.
Nude
a sock.
That's the sock, yeah.
He wore the sock, but the thing is that you have all these rich neighbors around the house. And so you see my grandfather's house and you see on the lawn, there's the wrestling ring. Cause in the summer, my grandfather would set the rings up.
Yeah.
Which stops like traffic, people walking
up. Cause everyone knows it's Stu Hart's place.
Yeah. And so, everybody wants to look at the ring.
People in the mansion above, there's the neurosurgeon. There's the, you know, the mayor, there's the, you know, lawyer.
Here's
the
circus freak.
And all of a sudden you have like, you know,
giants and midgets and
Muck and Sing on the lawn. Dwarf Mata. All sorts of like, and it was such a weird thing.
There's the famous story where Stu was cooking scrambled eggs and there was always a lot of cats in the house.
Yes.
Cats are getting mentioned quite a bit here.
Yeah.
And he was, I don't know if this is true or not, you probably know better than me, flipping the eggs and then saw some cat poop on the floor, used the spatula to pick up the cat poop and throw it in the trash and then kept making the eggs.
Yeah.
Urban legend.
What are your thoughts?
Well, can I?
The floor is yours.
Thanks. This is okay. So, I believe that there's a lot of truth to that rumor. Now, this is the reason why, because my grandfather had a very open mentality as far as the cats kind of ran the house.
And how many cats? Like 12 cats?
At one point, I think he probably had 14 or 15 cats, wow. But he also had a lot of dogs too. He had Molly, he had Punky, he had, I mean, he had a lot. Like people, he just took in animals.
Okay, yeah. He loved
so
animals.
He had about, you might say at any given time between 10 and 15 animals, but mainly cats. So there was a very strong odor, you know, cat pee. But the cats would be on the counters and stuff. And that's because the cats really ran the house. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather believed, you know, you couldn't smoke a cigarette in the house. It would be like the worst thing in the world. But you have that aroma of cat pee. And it was just kind of, even when I smell cat pee now, and this is showing how crazy and insane I am, I don't mind it because it reminds me of my grandfather's house. So the cats would be on the counters and like...
Good memories.
You know, everything is situational, especially sure. The dungeon, which had a lot of cat pee in it. But...
The dogs did their fair share in the dungeon too.
Yeah.
Let's not blame it all on the cats.
But Grampy was just very resourceful, and you know, he used different. I believe that Grampy probably at one point used.
Well, I watched
the spatula to definitely pick up something.
Yeah, because I've heard that story from different.
He
people.
He wouldn't be going to Safeway to buy a little plastic.
Including
one.
Tokyo Joe, my trainer had a story that he had a Japanese guy in the dungeon, and the guy
for sure
Stu said, "Hey, after training, I'll make some food." So. He had the exact same story that he saw the same, and he told Joe, I don't want to eat. I don't want to eat. I saw this. So then, like, Stu's making food, and then Joe's like, oh, sorry, Stu, we're busy. We must go. So they went and ate. But one that I witnessed was Stu making these wings for Helen. I was down in the dungeon training, and then I run into Stu late at night. He's making these wings. So then I end up carrying the plate up the metal stairs for him. Now we're on the main floor, and he's looking for like a plate to bring these up to Helen. And if Helen saw this, there's no way she would have eaten these wings. I see he pulls like a takeout container out of the garbage, kind of turns it, taps it a couple times to make sure nothing's in it, and puts these wings in this container. And if Helen saw that, she would have flipped out. And I was
I'm
like,
sure.
I was like, he's like, okay, well, I'm going up now. And I was like, I said, you need help carrying these up? No, I got it from here, thanks. And then
it's our secret.
And I was thinking, like, if she only knew.
I think though,
so then that started, I used to always think, there's no way this cat story's true. But once I saw that, and then I'm thinking.
I think Grampy probably washed off the spatula, like, washed it off.
Yeah.
I think he definitely.
Rinsed it.
Yeah. A good thorough rinsing.
Yeah. My grandfather just didn't, like, if you looked at his drawers in his kitchen, they were all, like, metal. Everything was industrial. There's no way I could see Grampy going to Safeway buying a plastic pooper scooper when he had a steel all-clad one in the drawer.
Perfectly good spatula that he could use.
You rinse it off, and it's fine. Five-second rule does not apply.
You know, and I remember at SummerSlam 1990, I went to Frank Sisson's Silver Dollar Center. I'd trained that summer. I hadn't even had a match yet, but we got to go to the Silver Dollar and watch the pay-per-view, and Stu was there. And I remember I got to kind of sit close. I remember Harry was running around. He was probably 5 years old. I thought it was dirt all over his face, but Harry reminds me that he had demolition paint.
Oh,
I remember just running around the place. And then Stu was there, and he kept taking sugar packs and putting them in his pocket. Like, at the end of the night, he'd probably taken 30 or 40 sugar packs and put them in his pocket to must take home for later. And I remember he was using a toothpick as a Q-tip. And I just thought that was the strangest thing. And he was like,
there's no way that feels good.
That's so funny.
But maybe his ears are so cauliflower, the regular Q-tip can't get in and
feel it. Who knows, right? Yeah, exactly. There's no other way to get him in there.
I know. I remember Grampy, too, because Smith would always go to the Salvation Army and bring back these things for my grandfather. And Grampy one time didn't have any underwear on, but it was just him by himself. He didn't know that there was house guests coming. And he came down the stairs.
He'd always just wear a shirt.
Mm-hmm. He'd always wear a big shirt. But Smith had got him this big yellow shirt from the Salvation Army. And on the front of it was a happy face. And on the back was
a marijuana leaf.
And then all of a sudden, these people from the Calgary Sun ended up coming over. My grandfather's in his kitchen with this marijuana leaf. And Grampy was like 75, you know, maybe 80 at the time. And I remember my grandfather, I don't even know if Grampy was there. But anyway, it was just that's the kind of person. My grandfather was so oblivious to everything. And he just loved any time people would come over. I remember when it could be, I mean, I don't even want to say this, but it could be like a, you know, it could be Saddam Hussein coming into the house, but if he had good calves, my grandfather would be like, you've got a solid pair of legs on you, or like,
you'd come over and flex your biceps and feel them. What are you about, 210? 215? Yeah, I'm about 220, Stu. Yeah, you did. That's good. This was probably when he was 75.
Yeah, it was.
Because they would always have to say, like, you know, maybe it was your mom or Diane or whatever, be like, Stu, this is Chris Jericho. Because it was like, the thing was that he trained in the dungeon, which I didn't train in the dungeon. I trained in Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp that had one Hart Brother for one day, which was Keith. But I came from Calgary, so therefore I'm one of the – I'm a Calgary kid, like you guys are. And so it'd be like, hey, he trained in the dungeon. And Stu would be like, he says, what's your name? Chris Jericho. Yeah, what are you about, 210, 215? Yeah, and then he'd go on his way. And then I'd see him again maybe later or whatever. What's your name? What are you about, 210? Yes, Stu. But it was always cool that I think towards the end, I think he actually knew who I was.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't ask me what my name was. He never said, hi, Chris. But he never said, what's your name? So I figured he probably had figured out that I'm in the gang
then
now.
You, face recognition.
Exactly.
Knew who you were.
Yeah. So you mentioned way back when we started this, the Sunday dinners, and that was a tradition. Every Sunday, no matter where you were, who was in town, you would go over there, right?
Every single Sunday.
And that was a mandatory thing.
Yeah, when we were growing up, we had this wrestling promotion called the Kids Wrestling Association. And so TJ can elaborate more on that, but every Sunday we'd have Sunday dinners, and there'd probably be maybe 50 people every single Sunday would come for the dinner. So if Brett and Owen were in town, they'd be there too.
Yeah.
So it would be this huge family affair, and it was just it was something we loved doing. It was a family tradition. My grandfather took so much pride in like cooking all the food, and he really loved it. But on the lawn, there was TJ and Harry and Ted and all the Hart grandkids basically running this wrestling promotion. And
how old were you guys?
I was 15, okay. So Ted's 15.
Very young.
12, 13.
Harry's 10.
And basically they had this promotion on the lawn. And so before Sunday dinners, we'd run shows. And, you know, it was
amazing.
It was really cool because my grandfather actually designed all of his own rings. And he, like, had a welder that, you know, worked for him. And they were huge.
Well, and also it's funny. So when we were doing this stuff, we didn't have that much experience in terms of, like, watching a lot of different wrestling. So we're just doing, like, a lot of basic, really basic stuff then. We got a fan sent a tape for Bash at the Beach when Hogan joins NWO. Mm-hmm. Well, while we're watching this, we come across Rey Mysterio. I've told Rey this story. We come across Rey Mysterio, Ted and I. And Rey against Psychosis, I could tell you everything about that match right now. We were so blown away. We rewind, watch it again, rewind, watch. And it was summertime. It was July when that happened. So we're watching at the guest house. Press pause, go out the ring setup. We go outside, we're trying Frankensteiners.
Yep.
Go back inside, press play. Okay, let's see if we can do this one now. Nowhere near the grace of Ray, but we're doing.
Sure.
You know, and now we want to show Stu this new stuff we've learned. I remember we're doing Frankensteiners, and we finally mustered up enough to do a superplex. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Ted's world, we're like both guys off the top because we're not weak. We're one guy just stands on the second. Mm-hmm. So here we are, these kids doing superplex. And all these run, and Stu, we're thinking, yes, you're going to love it. He's like, you guys are going to break your goddamn necks. And like, so angry at us. And
but
we're
wasn't
like,
Owen teaching you guys how to do stuff too?
Yeah, Owen would teach us like when the ring was set up and when he would be around, like he showed us how to do backflips off the top and things like that. And I remember Ted and I telling him that like we knew how to do some moves. We had no clue how a match worked. So he came down to the dungeon with us one time.
Owen or Stu?
Owen. Mm-hmm. And then he just said, okay, TJ, you're the heel. Ted, you're the baby face. And he said, and he just called like move for move and like do this. Okay, now put him in this hole, do this. And then.
Because you guys actually had a match at the Saddle Dome on a WWE show.
Yeah, in 1996.
Like, which, how old were you?
I just turned 16.
How in the hell did you guys get on a WWE? Can you imagine a WWE show now with a 16-year-old kids wrestling?
Harry was how old?
11.
11?
Yes.
Harry was 11.
In front of 5,000 people.
Yeah.
But Harry was 8 when he had his first match at the Rockyford Rodeo.
Which is like what inspired Ted and I to want to wrestle.
But Brett got them the match.
But who approved it?
Davey.
Carl DeMarco. Ted's brother passed away from flesh eating disease that
summer.
Okay.
So then like the family was really, really down. And then just somehow Davey and Owen were on the road. And Davey was talking with Carl DeMarco, who's the president of WWE Canada at the time. Mm. And then, who knows, I remember Davey said, okay, hey, TJ, you and Harry can do this singles match. But Carl DeMarco always really liked Ted. And then he called Ted. So Ted's like, hey, did you guys hear we're doing a tag match? And I was saying, thought we're doing a singles. But, okay, now it's a tag.
So what was the match?
It was myself, and we didn't know what we were doing, okay? But we trained a friend of ours so we could have a tag match. Myself and
who
this.
Who was the friend's name?
Andrew Pekarnik. He's a lifelong friend of Ted's and then of mine. So, Andrew, myself and Andrew against Ted and Harry. And we don't know. All we've done is like rehearse this match for weeks. Mm-hmm. We have no, for whatever reason, we have no guidelines about rules, about shaking hands, about like, at this time, we'd seen now a bunch of Ray stuff and some other light heavyweight stuff. So we're like, some of the Japanese super juniors, so we're trying to do all the stuff, dives.
We had these dives. We had all the stuff planned. We went early in the day just to make sure we could do it. We did it. Mm. The WWE ring, even though it was like all the guys say it was very stiff in those days, it was still so much better feeling than the Stampede ring
at night, yeah,
when everything gets kind of cold. And then padding on the outside, we're able to do everything that we'd planned. Probably didn't look great, but we were able to do everything that we planned. Wow. So we're like, yes, we got this. And then Jack Lanza sits on a bench across from us and doesn't go, hey, guys, listen up. He just starts talking. But we're so nervous. We're in the locker room with Shawn Michaels, yeah, Vader, Hunter.
Undertaker.
Yeah, we're exactly. These guys were all on the show. We're just sitting there. These kids, I weighed 90 pounds. So we're just sitting there, and like we're just kind of like keep saying the match to each other over and over and over. And we've been rehearsing it for weeks. And Lanza sits on a bench across from us. And finally, I'm like, Dad, I think he's talking to us. And he's like, catch him mid-sentence. He's like, you guys have 5 minutes. No two guys on the floor at the same time. This, when I give this signal, I pull my tie. The ref's going to tell you guys that that's, you guys got to go home. And I was like, thinking in my head, I wonder what's go home.
And then, Jack Lads is running the show. He's, yeah, he's the boss.
And then I was like, oh.
But like, you guys are doing is on the floor.
But we tried telling him, like, our match is longer than 5 minutes. No, no, you have 5 minutes. Okay.
If not, I'm sending Sater down to kill you.
So I was like, I said, we got together. We're like, we'll do our match we have planned. And when it's the time to go home, we'll go home. And then so, like, we're doing the match. And I hear Earl Hebner is actually the ref. He said, okay, guys, I'm getting the signal. So I'm like, I thought that Ted heard it too. Ted are in the ring. And we had this spot where he's going to give me a back suplex, stay with me, and do a second one where I take like a moonsault bump. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to go to that was probably going to be right towards the end. So I think Ted hears it. And he hooks me for the suplex. So I'm thinking in my head, okay, we'll cut out the first one, just do the backflip one. He's thinking, he didn't hear Earl. So I'm thinking backflip, Ted's thinking just regular suplex. I land on my head. But
oh.
And there's a picture. I have a picture on my phone from like the Calgary Herald of this great shot of me landing on my head. But I don't know if it's this one or the next one, because so then I'm thinking, so Ted's just thinking regular suplex, and he's thinking he's going to backflip me. I'm thinking, why is he doing the regular one now? So he's trying to backflip me. Well, I'm trying to take a regular one. So two in a row on my head. And finally Earl says, if you guys don't go home right now, I'm ending this match. We're all going to look stupid. And I was like, so nervous, and I'm like, Ted, and he's like, what? And he finally snapped out of it, and I said, we have to finish, and he's like, oh, okay. He tags Harry, sets me up on the top, superplex me. Harry does a headbutt off the other corner, like Power and Glory. At the same time, Barry Windham's on the show as the Stalker, okay? So we get to the back. We're in this little room. Barry Windham comes in. He's like, hey, you guys did my finish.
Which was a superplex?
Superplex.
Wow.
And so Ted doesn't miss a beat, and Ted's so funny because he has never changed it. Which I think is a good thing that, like, he's always just believed in himself, and that's Ted. But he goes, actually, no, you do yours. You stand on the second rope, and we did both guys off the top. And then like, as the timing would happen, Baby comes walking, and Barry's like, oh, I'm just messing with you guys. Great job. But, like, I remember thinking, oh, he's really funny. But later on when I'm wrestling, I'm thinking, if I saw some 16-year-olds.
Could you imagine? Yeah.
If they did something similar that I do, and, like, if I was just like, hey, guys, like,
I gave you some crap about it.
Yeah. So, like, was he really joking, or was he kind of mad? Yeah. Or since it's a live event, maybe he doesn't. Yeah. I don't know. There's could be a million things.
Well, we've had so many crazy stories, but the last story I want to talk about is finally, we mentioned earlier, the big screw job. Bret Hart's gone from the WWE for 14 years, finally comes back. WrestleMania, Hart versus McMahon.
Right.
With the Hart family involved. I think there might have been a Hall of Fame thing that night, too.
Stu was inducted.
So the whole family is there.
Right.
For
which,
for
the by match. The way, is the first time the whole family's been together since Stu's funeral.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And really rocky since Owens passed.
Right. Because that's where the family really got divided after.
Insanely
that.
Divided.
Right.
And then, like, so then they, even though everybody was there at Stu's funeral, still very much divided, not talking. Like, your mom and Brett, maybe first time they really talk is Phoenix.
Yeah.
At the WrestleMania. Yeah.
It was hard because after Owen had passed away, the family just really, like, it really, really
splintered the family. I remember.
It really affected the family.
Because you're either on Owen's side or Vince's side.
Well, because our family just loves wrestling so much, and it's just a big, it's everything that makes us tick. So, you know, I can't remember a day in my life that we haven't talked about wrestling or watched it or just been involved in it. So, obviously with Owen's passing, it was really hard because, you know, you understand both sides, but just it is part of who we are still. So there was a little, there's a huge division, and we still just wanted to keep loving wrestling because it was actually very therapeutic.
And some of the family's still working, making their living for Vince. Davey was, I believe.
Davey and my dad and
that's
Brett.
Right. Jim was too, right.
And Brett was, you know, still, well, Brett was in WCW, but anyway, so we had this huge family reunion, and in a lot of ways, I think it was therapeutic to bring everybody together, but in typical True Heart fashion, of course, the family would find a way to fight about something, and basically...
Well, there was a few. The first one was Allison telling off Johnny.
With John, John was head of Johnny.
John Laurinaitis.
Yeah, John Laurinaitis was head of talent relations at the time. And I don't think my Aunt Allison knew who John was. So she, I don't even know why she did this, but anyway, she was hungry or she didn't have food or something like that. She ended up basically giving John Laurinaitis a piece of her mind on Thursday. The whole thing wasn't even until Saturday.
What do you mean you didn't get food? It's not like she was in jail or something.
I don't know.
She just go downstairs and buy some food?
Hungry or something wasn't working out for her. Or like she just was having a bad hair day. And all of a sudden, Brett was like, you guys can't be telling off John Laurinaitis.
He's like, Sunday or Monday, you guys fly home. But TJ, Natty, and Harry are still here. You guys can't be doing this.
Yeah, and they were acting like...
Well, that shouldn't affect them because he's like, yeah, but you don't understand... He's like, Ross, do you have rocks in your head? This is like... It was breaking down Saturday night after the Hall of Fame. Michael Hayes comes up to us in the Hall of Fame and he says, hey, come meet up in the green room after this.
We had no idea that we were going to be involved in it until the night before.
This is in the match.
Yeah.
So after Hall of Fame, you guys are going to the green room to discuss tomorrow's
They pull us aside and say, just so you know, now you guys are a part of this. And we're like, what?
So the first thing, we're sitting there and then Vince is laying out what's going to happen.
So you're in there with Vince and 12 hearts.
And
basically,
and like Sean and Hunter are also around.
Okay,
because like they're just around. Is very like,
going over stuff.
It was very crazy. So like we're there, and then Vince is kind of laying it out. Then Bruce interjects. First thing, he just lines out that like Brett with the concussion and the head trauma can't take any blows and can't take any falls. Yeah. So. Then, so the story is that we're all going to be lumberjacks, that Vince bought us out, but that Brett actually caught it ahead of time and we're actually all swerving.
Oh, yeah, Vince was going to buy off the whole Hart family with Brett.
But then we're actually all on Brett's side.
Yeah.
And then Bruce right away is like, no, this doesn't make sense. Then that basically turns you babyface because you got all of us against you. I think you should get some real good steam on Brett and he's bleeding. And then they're like, well, there's no more blood here.
Brett can't take any blows.
So they try to like keep going. Vince hasn't even begun to like lay it out. He just had started, and Bruce already interrupted him. Then like Vince goes a little bit further than Bruce, like, and I think like you know because they did the deal where Batista beat up Brett on Raw, so I think Batista should come out. And then Triple H comes out, and then
Michael
like,
Hayes goes,
and then Michael's like, Batista's kind of got a big match that night, which is Batista against Cena.
Batista's kind of got a big match.
And then he's like, then Vince gets a little bit further, and Bruce's like, yeah, I just think that, you know, really get some good steam on Brad. He's bleeding. Here comes Triple H, maybe. Then Triple H and Vince, and then here comes Shawn. And Shawn, then it turns out you set up SummerSlam, Shawn and Brad against Triple H and Vince. And then finally Brett says, hey, there's no blood. I can do this one match. Guys, gotta let you
shut up.
So now Bruce has decided to stop talking openly to the whole room and just starts maybe speaking to like Keith beside him, but loudly,
whispering
loudly. I just think that, if there's no heat and there's no blood, there's no steam, how can anyone get behind it? And then
my mom stands up out of nowhere and I'm just like, oh. And my dad's not in this room because my dad, like I said, when we started this interview, my dad is the most normal of the hearts. And I stand by this. Yeah. And my dad stayed the hell away because he's too smart.
He knows what's going to happen.
And so my mom's like, well, just out of nowhere says, I think Jim needs to be involved.
Again, I think maybe Bruce first threw the idea. What is Big Jim involved? And then I was like, yeah, maybe Jim should be involved. And then they actually kind of thought about it for a second. They're like,
but then it turns into a Hart Foundation.
They're like, if he's steamrolling Vince and he's so big.
Yeah, so I told my mom, I'm like, mommy, stop. And then my mom started crying and I was like, oh, sakes. Excuse my language. Gosh.
It just gets you fired up.
So fired up.
And then what about the referee?
Oh, and then they're like, okay, then the referee.
Well, Wayne was always the referee in Stampede Wrestling, so wasn't there some debacle?
Yeah, so like the referee's going to be Bruce, and then like I was like, but I always thought Wayne was always the referee in
Wayne's
Stampede.
Wayne's the ref of the family.
And then Brett always tells us, it's so funny, but Brett Allison goes, I think Wayne needs to be the referee. And Brett's like he's mouthing down.
He's like, stop it. And then without causing a scene, Brett's trying to say like, yeah, we're crazy, but we're able to get through something together.
Right.
But we're not. But
yeah, then yeah, Brett tells Allison to stop, and then Allison starts crying. And then after Allison stops crying, she looks at Brett, and Brett always just cracks me up when he tells me this. He goes, she looked at Brett, and she's like, she mouthed like whispering, I love you. And Brett's like, it just is so funny.
By the way, we're not even at like the bell ringing at this point of going over what's happening.
And it was just fighting.
And so the big thing was
Vince doing?
Laughing.
Knowing how crazy the parts are.
I think he's just like those Terminator eyes. He's just like almost taking like photographs of like.
But the way Vince is that he's like Harry. He's entertained by this stuff. Well,
that is the truth. I remember Vince always said, you know, the hearts are going to be the hearts. You know, God bless the hearts. Oh, Ellie, she's such a firecracker. Like whatever. You know,
yeah. Is, right? My mom was always very passionate too. Like when we were growing up, she'd always write Vince these long letters, and I was like, oh.
So he knew what he was getting into. He was probably saying, wait till you get a load of this.
Yeah.
Having them all come in, bring them all in the green room, Hayes.
I don't think my dad ever knew when he was part of the Heart Foundation that my mom was writing Vince's letter.
And even a small part that ends up getting blown up the next day a little is that the whole thing is Bruce is supposed to come out with a blazer on, mm-hmm. and then he takes off the blazer to reveal that he's the ref. And Bruce like, for whatever reason, I'm not going to wear a jacket. Why would I wear a jacket? Why would I wear a jacket?
I'm a sellout.
So,
wear my bandanarama.
So he's in Gorilla. And Vince is already out there because Vince goes out and then he calls us out. So Vince is already out there. And then like Hunter now is taking over Vince's spot in Gorilla. And he's like, Bruce, where's your jacket? He's like, oh, I didn't want to wear it. So he actually goes out wearing Kidman's jacket. Like, Kidman, give me your jacket. Kidman gets his jacket off, gets it on Bruce right before he steps with the curtain. Just because for some weird reason, and it's definitely a heart trait. Like, Ted has it a lot. But if you get told what to do,
yes,
you can't do it because you were told. If
you refuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially from the man.
Yeah, I don't care. On any battle, I get
I feel like you might be kind of slightly heart.
Yeah, well,
I feel like you have a little heart in you.
I'm an honorary heart.
Yeah, you are.
Definitely.
It's
have
funny.
That,
Mick Foley is like, you think I could be an honorary heart? And I'm like, Mick is actually definitely crazy enough to be part of the heart. And I think he would eat eggs used with a spatula.
He probably would.
Scooping up cat poop.
I saw he had a tuxedo in a plastic bag in his trunk that he took out and wore every once in a while. It's like, well, you never know when you're going to need a tuxedo. So you keep it balled up in a plastic bag in your trunk? Well, you never know. Shouldn't you have it on a hanger, in a thing? You know.
But he fits in with the crazy hearts.
He does. But you guys come from one of the greatest families, one of the most respected families. I love the hearts, and I'm glad we got to talk about this today. It was a lot of fun, a lot of great stuff.
And you know what's funny? Because you're – like I said, because you're an honorary heart, it's so easy to talk to you about this kind of stuff. And now that I'm reading your third book, which can be found at a Kindle near you.
At a fine bookstore near you.
But it's funny because like I'm like, gosh, there's so many funny heart stories. And like,
you should write a book.
Yeah, reading your
My
books.
My family.
I start, after reading your books and reading some of these, I'm like, gosh, I want to write a book. Because, it's just so fun to talk about it. But I won't.
That's something you should do someday. Yeah. Write a whole recollection of the hearts from your grandfather to your dad to growing up. I think it'd be very interesting.
Which is crazy, you were saying earlier about, mine and Cody's memory. But, Brett, too, his memory is so sharp. And you think, the concussion and the stroke. And I'll sit with Brett and he'll just tell stories and it'll be different ones that I hadn't heard before it's so sharp and it's unbelievable.
60 years of stories.
So I mean, you get a real compilation of these heart stories.
Yeah,
it'd be insane.
It'd be great. This is just a taste of it.
Yeah.
You can borrow the book, TJ, after I'm done reading it.
For proof edit.
Yeah, it's the best in the world at
what I have
at
no
what
idea.
I don't know.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, thanks to Tyson Kidd and Natty Neidhart. Tyson just going through a serious surgery on the recovery track. He's a great guy. We believe in Tyson Kidd. We want Tyson Kidd to get better. I want you to send all of your well wishes to Tyson Kidd right now. Let him know how you feel. Go on the Twitter, and I want you to hit up at KidWWE, all right? That's his Twitter handle, at KidWWE. Go on there and let him know you're thinking of him. He is a tough son of a bitch. He's a great performer. He's a great worker. He loves wrestling, and he is going to get back in shape. I just know it because that's what he does. That's what Canadians do. That's what hearts do. That's what we do. I'm going to send him a text on my phone when I get home from Japan. And why not, right? Because I do everything on my phone nowadays, email, text, pay bills, watch movies, listen to music, video chat, even shop, right? The phone is my office, especially when I'm on the road, especially when I'm overseas. So what if I told you you could add buying a car to that list of stuff you can do on your smartphone, huh? What if I told you that? Well, if you download the TrueCar app, you can do that. You can take care of your car buying without spending hours and hours at dealerships looking for the perfect car and haggling over price. TrueCar has created a mobile app that makes buying a new car simple and fun. Download the TrueCar app, and in 5 minutes, you create the car you want. You choose the make, model, special features, even the color. And once you have your specs filled out, you see what others paid for the same car. And when I say others, I'm talking people in your neighborhood, people in your zip code. Once you do all that, you lock in guaranteed savings from TrueCar certified dealers in your area. That's over $3,000 off MSRP. Now, that's making smart use of your mobile phone, all right? They've got an app for everything these days. How many can actually save you a serious chunk of change? $3,000? Imagine what you can do with that. It's summertime, man. You go to the beach, go to the lake, do some jet skiing, do some fishing, you know, buy a flat screen giant TV so you can watch Tough Enough on the USA Network. You go to a Fozzy gig, go to a WWE Y2J winter tour, summer tour gig, and go in the winter. You got so much money to spend, you can do what you want. Bottom line is, you got a big chunk of change, you got a great car, you're doing it yourself, you do the smart thing, you download the TrueCar app, and you save time, save money, save us Y2J, and never overpay. Download that TrueCar app and do it today. Thanks again to Nadia and Tyson. So much fun hearing all those great Hart family stories. What a unique, whimsical, wacky family. Yeah. And great to have Nadia back for a second round on Talk is Jericho. She's one of the first guests ever on this podcast. You can check out our first conversation. That episode is still available on iTunes and podcast1.com. I think it was like episode 15 or something along those lines. She is great. Tyson is great. And you guys are all great. Thank you so much for joining me on this show and joining me this summer on the Y2J Summer Tour. We're continuing tonight at the Tokyo Sumo Hall. In Japan, right, in July 4th, tomorrow with Neville in Tokyo, July 10th in Philly, 11th Pittsburgh, 31st San Diego, 1st Ontario, 2nd Fresno. Go on to WWE.com, find out all the dates, and go to FozzyRock.com to find out our remaining summer dates. We've got a handful left in Canada. We're playing in the Square in Kitchener, July 24th, the festival there. August 8th, Festival of Friends in Ontario and Hamilton, another festival. August 9th, another festival, Heavy Montreal in Montreal. And then we're hitting the high seas with the Kiss Navy October 30th with Kiss, and then heading back over to Europe and the UK November 14th. That starts in Germany all the way to December 6th. Go to FozzyRock.com and check out all the gig info and all the VIP info. Come rock with us. I'm inviting you right now. All right. And inviting you to join me next week on More Talk is Jericho's. And I thank you for being here. Thank you for checking out my sponsors as well, including Koios, Recovery Max, TrueCar, DDP Yoga. And of course, the sponsors been with us since number one, Amazon. It's the easiest way to support this show. Go buy the new Black Veil Brides live DVD, Alive and Burning. Go buy the new Tremonti album, Cauterize. Go buy one of Scott Baio's albums from the 70s. If you find one of those, get me one too. I want to hear it. Go to podcast1.com. Click on the Support Our Show sponsors banner at the top of the page. And hit the Talk is Jericho button. Amazing links on Amazon for the USA, the UK, and the Canada. Every time you do that, you contribute a couple bucks to this show so we can keep running this show for you for free for twice a week. There's no extra fees, no hidden challenges. You're just doing your shopping. Help me out in the process. I thank you for that. And I thank you for being here. Thanks to Tyson. Thanks to Natty. Thanks to Scott Baio. And next week, Wednesday, my old friend, the singer from Slipknot and Stone Sour, Corey Taylor, returns to Talk is Jericho. We talk all things rock and roll, parenting, and his new book. Some great, great stuff. Always funny to have Corey on the show, and always great to have you. So we will see you next week. Happy Independence Day. Happy Canada Day a few days ago. And happy Yeah Boy Day. Nicholas says, Yeah Boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.